Hi, I'm Patrick Palm, and this is the Learn from Leaders podcast. In this show, I interview favorite customers and other interesting leaders in product development, marketing, HR, executive management, investors. You find favorite leaders in many different places and in organizations doing game development and publishing, software as a service and other tech companies and big enterprises, you know, going from very centralized command and control kind of organizations to a more modern way of working with a culture with high team autonomy and better alignment towards the company goals and values. So let's go.
John, tell me, what's been the biggest crossroads in your career?
Biggest crossroads? I'd say there's been two big ones, two definitive ones. The first one was moving from enterprise software, ERP software, to game development. And I took an intentional year and a half break before making that transition. My wife and I decided to do the mid-30s, sell the house, and travel the world for a year and a half, which is still to this day, I think, one of the best things they've ever done. And if you can swing it, I highly recommend it to people. It broadened my horizons far past, you know, what I grew up with and certainly everything here in the U.S. So it was really the first time, other than traveling to Canada and Mexico and a single business trip to the U.K., that I'd really been out of the country. So seeing 26 countries and really having the time to spend in each of those 26 countries, as opposed to, you know, being a tourist on a 2 week or maybe even a 1 week vacation is very eye opening. And it was then that I moved, you know, I decided that I wanted to still be involved in technology and software, but I wanted to do something more creative. And I'd always been a fan of video games. I'd always played video games, and it just so happened on the trip to meet an executive producer for Microsoft Game Studios. And he said, "Hey, when you're done with this trip, you know, give me a call and we'll see if we can make something happen." And so, super fortuitous, that's what I ended up doing. Gave him a call, went through the extensive Microsoft interviews, and ended up moving with my wife to Salt Lake City, Utah, to a Microsoft game studio there, working on a launch title for the Xbox 360, which was AMP 3, even though it shipped not as a Microsoft game studio title, but as a 2K title. And that was my first exposure to how tumultuous the game industry can be. And then my second one was really kind of transitioning out of games to be more on the vendor side. And I did that with you, Patrick. I did that when I was the head of the Rock Band franchise at Harmonix Music Systems, working specifically on Rock Band 3. And we were using Handsoft. And you and I ended up having a conversation. And I ended up, you know, coming to Sweden to meet you and the other two founders. And, you know, before I knew it, I was then moving to Sweden with the family. Which I love. So another huge transition, and quite frankly, a transition that I would have never been open to if I hadn't done that previous trip around the world. So, you know, and it is a big difference, obviously, compared from traveling, even extensively traveling, to actually being an expat in another country. And it's, again, another situation where one of the best moves of my life, right? I mean, you and I have known each other ever since. That was coming up on, I think, 16, 17 years ago. And plus I get to experience life in Sweden and see what it's like to actually live as essentially a citizen. I got my person number in another country. So yeah, those are the two. Those are the two big ones.
Yeah, and it was a truly great experience, you know, working with you then, and I think
you adjusted really well to Sweden. You know, I think you became more Swedish than the Swedes at the company, you know. So, but I guess you had the experience that was probably impossible for you to learn in the Swedish, because no one would speak Swedish with you, right? Everything would be in English, right?
I remember when you and I were on the train to from Uppsala to Stockholm, and I asked you that. I said, so I should probably learn Swedish, right? And you said, well, I mean, you can if you want, but there's only 7 million Swedes and we all essentially speak perfect English, so you might want to focus your efforts elsewhere.
That is how it is.
And if I had stayed, I mean, I was there for 3 years, but if I had stayed longer, I definitely would have made the effort to learn the language. But as you say, it is difficult to learn, because even if you're checking out at the ICA or whatever, they can tell that you can't speak Swedish, so they instantly speak to English. It's too easy to speak English in Sweden.
Yeah, and a lot of the Swedish companies, both tech startups and really large enterprises, like for example Ericsson, that we also had a privilege to work with. You know, it was one of our customers with Hemsoft, and you and I worked together on that. It was more than 10,000 users of our software, and I remember every time we walked into a room having a meeting with them, it was kind of like United Nations. There would always be like so many nationalities. If you had a room with, let's say, 10 participants, it would be several nations represented in that meeting. And I think it's very typical for companies in Sweden, because it's, since we're such a small domestic market, we kind of have to be born global if we're selling a product. It's of course a little bit different if you're a service business, but if you're building and selling a product, you kind of have to go international from day one, and that makes it very natural to have an international team.
Yeah, I certainly appreciated that. I mean, it made the transition so much easier to not have to learn the language right away. And I think Sweden in general makes the transition for expats super easy. Within a month I had a person number, which is essentially the equivalent of a social security number here in the US. And that's a minimum 5-year process to get something like that in the US, right? And I literally, within another 2 months, we had dentists and doctors calling us and saying, I'm your new dentist, I'm your new doctor, which is an incredibly painful process in the US to find a doctor and find a dentist. Even with really good health insurance, it's difficult. So I certainly appreciated those aspects of living in Sweden.
All right, cool. So, I mean, we're still working together, because you started your own consulting firm, Broadco Insights, and we're in a partnership. So very often, Favro customers, they don't want to achieve status quo and implement the tool. It's typically part of a bigger transition. They want to move towards some more efficient way of working. Maybe you can tell a bit about what is a typical problem that the customers come with you at Broadco.
I think typically it's, they just want a better way of working, right? I mean, if they're changing tools, which is quite often the case, they don't just want to take on a new, more flexible tool. At the same time, it's a really good opportunity for them to improve their ways of working, whether that's through increased agility or becoming more flow-based, working with Kanban and flow-based metrics. So those are all of the things that I can help with, right? And I also have product management experience too. So
especially in the game development space, where I worked as a producer for years, both as kind of a project management type producer and also more of a product manager type producer, where you're responsible for the product itself, in that case being a game. Same thing within enterprise software, I kind of took on both roles. So I think I offer a unique perspective coming from and having exposure to so many different industries and so many different sides of the product development spectrum that can really help. And it's much more than just the tool, right? I mean, the tool is in a lot of ways, I think the tool is super important. And that's why I'm a big fan of Favro, because it is so flexible. It doesn't force you to work in a certain way like most tools do. You can really make the tool work for you and how your teams want to work. So it's important, especially with a flexible tool like Favro, to really kind of embrace a certain way of working. And if that certain way of working is becoming more adaptable as opposed to being more predictable, say, or focusing on maybe what we're going to talk about a little bit later, the product operating model, and truly having empowered product teams as opposed to more traditional hierarchies and feature teams that are just basically cranking out features that different stakeholders want them to, which may or may not benefit the customer at all. Those are the things that I specialize in. Those are the things I can really help with. And that's what we do through Broad Cove.
Yeah. And, you know, as you said, you know, I really wanted to, jump into this conversation with you to talk about the product operating model, both through, Marty Kagan's book, but also his consulting and through his talks at conferences. It's taking off a lot. It's becoming, very popular. I was about to say very hyped, but I realized that that might sound a little bit negative, which is not what I mean. And I think there's a lot of really good stuff, happening with this. So I would really like to get your perspective on this, and I have many questions on it. But before getting into that, I think we need to start a bit in what you just said on your own experience, talking about, product management, because if I look back at, last 20 years when I've been working with, various types of companies on how they organize themselves, people having a title with, product management in it, if it's, product manager or, VP product management, I mean, there's many titles. They can mean quite different things. It can be very much on the business side. It can be very much more on the product side. How do you think, about product management? What does it really mean to you?
And that's a big part of the problem, actually, with a lot of titles and a lot of these different roles, is that they mean so many different things, as you say, based on what organization you're a part of. And that just adds to the confusion. I mean, it's the same thing with agile titles, with Scrum titles. I mean, a product owner at one company can be very different from a product owner at another company. And, I think it's also true with product management. And one of the things that I really like about the product operating model, before we get to it even, is that a product manager, and the same thing with a product owner, has to be empowered. I mean, to be a true product manager or to be a true product owner, even if you're using Scrum and Scrum terminology, you have to be empowered to actually make decisions on how you're going to solve certain problems, right? And too often, product managers are just product managers by title, and certainly true with product owners. They aren't truly empowered to make those decisions. They instead become, and you hear this a lot, right? They instead become backlog managers. They spend all their time prioritizing the backlog, breaking down user stories, writing user story. And that's not what people
that's not really what people in the product world aspire to be. They don't want to be backlog managers. So, and then you get into an even more complicated situation where you'll have a product manager and a product owner. And then typically what happens is the product owner essentially becomes almost the assistant to the product manager, which is also not how it was meant to be. In an ideal world, right, if you have the title product manager, you truly want to have the power that should come along with it, which is to determine a solution to a problem that benefits both the customer and the business itself, right? And truly also bringing together business and technology instead of having this, you know, us versus them mentality, which is certainly present in many larger traditional Fortune 500 type companies.
So you touched upon Agile, and, you know, obviously we've both been in that space for a very long time. And an observation that I made recently that I would like to get your take on is that Agile is a little bit out of fashion right now, but it takes two forms. It is the constructive, positive form, which is that the prediction that Alistair Cockburn did in his keynote at an Agile conference many, many years ago that I was at, you know, he said, you know, in 10, 15 years, we're not going to talk about Agile software development or Agile product development anymore. It's just going to be, he was specifically talking about software development there, so I'm going to quote him right. So he said, you know, we're just going to talk about software development. There's going to be no like Agile software development. That's just going to be software development. And I do see that happening with companies that have been good, you know, companies that have adapted Agile methods and are successful with it and are not only, you know, doing Agile, but, you know, being Agile. So I see that these organizations, they don't really talk about it so much anymore because now it's really part of their DNA and how basically how they work. And the other things that they're focusing now in terms of, you know, improving their way of working. And then you have the other group I've seen where, you know, they have had, you know, big initiatives around Agile, but they never succeeded in being Agile. They were just, you know, doing some of the ceremonies and all that, but it didn't really work out. You know, they didn't succeed in being Agile, and there it has been a bit of a backlash. And well, to simplify it, you know, kind of being like, well, that didn't work, so we don't like that anymore. So this is kind of like, you know, my observation. You know, do you share that observation, or do you see it in a different way?
I mean, I agree. I think overall, I agree. I think there's still even the distinction of being Agile versus doing Agile has kind of fallen out of fashion to a certain extent. It's really come down in my mind to two things, right? There's a lot of organizations, product organizations or development organizations that consider themselves Agile, right? So they don't even want to talk about Agile anymore because they think, as you're saying, they already are Agile. Where in fact, you know, they most likely aren't. Because, I mean, what it really comes down, say a safe organization for something, for example, as Marty Kagan says, right, safe is the antithesis of the product operating model, and in many ways, the epitome of fake agile, because there is no such, it just continues to substantiate the hierarchy of the organization as opposed to having a truly empowered product organization across all levels. And that's a big difference, right? And the other thing too is that you can be, you know, doing Scrum, you can be doing Kanban, you can be doing XP and say you're Agile. But if you're not continuously deploying and releasing valuable solutions, right? Valuable software to your customers, then you're not agile, right? There's so many teams that maybe, you know, working in Scrum, working in sprints, you know, working in continuous flow Kanban, but they're still not really, they're still releasing maybe once a quarter, or they're maybe even worse, releasing once a year, right? And that's not agile. So I think real agile in many ways really boils down to, are you continuously releasing value to your customers, whether it's, you know, players in it for a game, or if it's, you know, customers of your project management SaaS tool, right? It's how often are you releasing, and how often are you using those releases to learn and adapt as you go?
You know, what you're saying reminds me about what a quote by Mary Popenick that, wrote, Lean Software Development, a book that became very popular, you know, many years ago. And I might quote her a little bit wrong now, but it was basically something like, you know, don't measure doing agile, measure the results you're getting from your new, process, basically. I'm totally misquoting her here, but the sentiment of it was right. Basically, you know, like it's not about how many rituals and what kind of process you implemented. It's really about, what are the results you're seeing from it? And then it's really down to whatever works. Some ideas, there was a very famous Swedish CEO back in the 80s, and he wrote a book called Tear Down the Pyramids. It was very much around having an enterprise organization that should, maybe not be so tall in its hierarchy, and make it more flat. And that would be more efficient, because you would also be more adaptable to what happens in the market. And I mean, this was back in the 80s, but you know, now we would probably see these ideas as something, part of an agile framework. But also, you know, if we look at the product operating model, it's kind of like part there. Go ahead.
You're hitting it right on the head. As far as, I mean, we talk a lot about transformation, right? When I was doing pure agile coaching, that's what we were in there for. We're in there to do an agile transformation, right? And now you're hearing a lot about companies transforming into this more empowered product teams, this product operating model. And as most people will tell you, the number one reason why any type of transformation fails is because of resistance. And it's typically resistance at that middle layer, right? It's at that middle layer of management, where they don't want to lose power, essentially. You know, they don't want to lose sway over their teams. And as soon as you start talking about cross-functional, with which both, you know, product organizations and agile organizations are all about cross-functional, right? Cross-functional empowered teams, then that's a hot button for somebody who's head of engineering, or in video games, somebody who's head of animation. Because they feel like, well, where does that leave me if my team members are all spread across all these other cross-functional teams? And there's an answer to that, right? Marty Kagan, really, again, he does a good job of calling those types of people, those managers of the different disciplines and on those cross-functional teams, they should think of themselves as product leaders, right? They're in there as servant leaders, almost like product coaches or an agile coach would do, but specific to their discipline, clearing the way, making sure that people who may report to them, right, are not only empowered, but also have all the tools, have all the knowledge, have all the training to really excel and perform at their jobs. And that's a big mindset change, right? And that's where you find a lot of the resistance coming from any type of transformation. And that's unfortunate, because sometimes with that, you know, in extreme situations, that's when you get the scenario where they say, well, if we're really going to make this happen, then we have to eliminate, to a certain extent, middle management, and that's really not the solution either. Or, you know, what SAFE tries to do is we're just going to maintain essentially that middle layer, but we're going to put different titles on it, like release train engineer. And I don't want to talk too much about that because it's far too easy to bash any specific framework. And you know, SAFE has certainly been bashed plenty. So I don't want to go down that road.
Well, I mean, just a you know, final comment on that, because I had conversations, you know, publicly about that too, and I think a lot of the bashing of SAFE has been correct. But if you look at the latest iteration of SAFE, you know, SAFE 6.0, it has become more flow based. So it also feels like, you know, they've been listening to the critique and are actually moving in a better way. I do think SAFE 6.0 is better than previous iterations of it. But any day I would choose, you know, going with the product operating model. There's also some other models we can discuss some other time, like you know, flight levels, that I think is also having a good approach. But before we go deep here on the product operating model, I have another observation I kind of want to get your take on. And that is that there's definitely a large increase in focus on product management. If we talk about like what are people talking about at conferences, in you know, blog posts, et cetera, there's a lot of, you know, talk about product management. And I have one observation I have there is that sometimes it can feel a little bit like, you know, the revenge of the business person, you know, towards the engineers. It's like, you know, because Agile has been such a big thing for a while, and Agile was very kind of like bottom up driven, and now it's almost like it's like the revenge of the business person. So if I just start there before I share my next observation, is there some truth in that, or is it just my like read of the discourse?
So spot on. I so completely agree with that. It's absolutely nail on the head, right? The whole Agile movement was very developer focused. It's the whole thing of, you know, working software as the primary measure of progress. I mean, all the Agile principles and values are still relevant, certainly, but it did definitely come from the development side, and there was, and I think that kind of didn't help, right? It added to this us versus them. The business side, the strategy side versus the technology versus the development side. And that doesn't serve anybody ultimately. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And now it's kind of going the other way, or it definitely has been going the other way for quite some time, because of so many failed Agile transformations and some you know, the 2-day certifications, and all of a sudden you're a Scrum Master, right? There's been so many flaws in the way the Agile movement has evolved that has led to the problems with it, that you're right. It's kind of the revenge of product. I mean, that kind of sums it up in a lot of ways. And that's one of the things, again, right, that I love about this product operating model, because it's really focuses on not the us versus them and a unified organization.
So before getting into that, my final observation here before we go all in on the product operating model. So, okay, so it seems like we agree with each other that there's a lot of buzz generally about product management, and again, my observation is that it falls into two categories where there's one direction where this falls that I think is maybe not so productive, where it's still very much us versus them, and it becomes very linear. So it's almost like going back to waterfall, that, you know, first is the business and then later comes the development, and it's just a very linear approach. And it feels like basically going backwards. And then there's the other, you know, the other direction where this falls, where, you know, probably the product operating model is the best manifestation, where it's still a focus on iteration, and fast iteration is something seen as very important. You know, the faster the teams can move, the faster the company can move, you know, the more competitive you're going to be. It's just that it's a wider, it's more of a full take on what does, you know, product mean. So to me, it seems like, you know, I'm obviously pretty biased here on what I think is the better one. But are you sharing that observation, you know, that it is going a little bit in these two directions?
The product side versus the development side, you mean?
No, not really. I mean, both are with a focus on you know, on product, but you know this kind of focus on product management being very important. So let's say that
there's a single reason for that, right? And I mean, you've heard these phrases multiple times. I'm sure I could probably ad nauseum of feature factory, right? Or outcomes over outputs, and that's a kind of another unfortunate aspect of the agile movement, is that teams who did get good at agile ways of working became really good at creating a lot of stuff, a lot of outputs, a lot of features. And that's where the feature factory term comes from, right? So they're cranking out features, but are they features anybody wants? Or even worse, right? They're features that the customer doesn't want, but individual stakeholders on the business side of the organization want those features for their own agenda, typically. And so then you get into this whole feature factory situation where, you know, you're not going to grow the business that way, because you've lost your customer focus, and you're not achieving the outcomes with those outputs. So that's been, and things, it's always a pendulum, right? So it's going back the other way, where now there's a huge focus on the product management side, which is all about outcomes. It's all about discovery. And is this something that the customers are going to want? Is this something that's actually going to improve the customers' lives before we build it? And that's one of the big differences between, you know, product model versus agile, so to say, is that it is far more focused on outcomes other than just cranking out a bunch of outputs. And, you know, I think that's a good thing. I think ultimately that's a good thing. I think that, you know, we're getting to the point where we can finally meet in the middle. And you probably know that I'm running this Agile Alliance, Agile Product Management Initiative. And that's a big thing that we want to achieve, is unifying these two worlds, product people and agile people, because they share so many of the same ideologies. They share so many of the same philosophies. And even in the product operating model itself, right, it's basically a given that agile is perfect for the third dimension of the product operating model, which is the delivery dimension. It's figuring out how we build these solutions. And that's not going away. And a lot of teams have gotten really good at that part of it. It's now has to be more focused. It's, are we building the right things? And there wasn't enough attention spent on that. And now hopefully there will be.
Yeah. So let's get a little bit deeper into the model. You know, Marty Kagan, you know, he wrote this book called Inspired, with the subtitle, you know, how to create tech products customers love. And I think that subtitle like summarizes quite well you know, what this is about. You know what you said there, it's not about just cranking out a lot of stuff at the higher speed than ever. You know, it has to be, you know, stuff that customers actually love. So you know, if for someone, you know, who hasn't read the book, I mean, how would you summarize the product operating model?
I'm a big fan of that book. I'm actually a bigger fan of his other book, Transformed, which goes deeper into the operating model itself, the product model itself. But to sum it up, right, and the good news is it's not some overcomplicated process. It's, in fact, it's not a process or a framework or a methodology at all. It's just the conceptual model of how really good product organizations build products that have turned them into unicorns or turned them into, you know, hugely successful companies. And it's basically taking those principles, it's taking those ideas and using them to transform companies that didn't grow up that way. They didn't grow up product focused, right? So, and he's, you know, he does a really good job of bringing this conceptual model that's been around for 20 plus years and describing it, packaging it in a way that's very digestible. And I think that's a kind of a hallmark of any thought leader, right? Is that they're able to take something that's been around for a long time and somewhat simplify it and put it into a very digestible form or package, which these books and his articles and videos have become. And that's why it's become so talked about. And it really just boils down to things that have kind of already existed. We've always kind of talked about the three levels, but, you know, very distinctly, strategy now is focused on which problems we want to solve. And discovery is very simply, how are we going to solve those problems that we've determined that we do want to solve? And then delivery is, how are we going to actually build those solutions? And it's a very clear, the product model offers a very clear way of how to go about changing your mindset or ways of working in those three distinct dimensions, right? But the number one thing is that in order for it to work, all three of those dimensions have to be unified. It's not like you say waterfall where you're, you know, constantly, we're going to spend 6 months working on the strategy, and then we're going to spend another 6 months working on the discovery, then another, you know, whatever on the delivery, waterfall way of doing it. This is all happening simultaneously, right? It's all one single empowered product organization. And that's what makes it so powerful. And I think one of the things that really clicked for me, coming more from the agile side of things, where I've spent the vast majority of my time, is the discovery piece, right? In that, yeah, you can say, and as a product owner is essentially supposed to encompass what a product manager does. It didn't really work out that way. And unify the business with development, with technology. And the real problem has come from it being so development focused, as you said. And now with the product operating model, what we're kind of doing instead is saying, you know, what we did from an agile perspective is you said, well, yeah, we can tell what the customer wants because we're just going to iteratively and incrementally deliver software to them super fast, these features, and see if they use them and see if they like them and get feedback super fast. The problem with that, though, is that you actually have to build that software. And that's very expensive, relatively. So wouldn't it be better if instead we did more product discovery before we even started the development, right? And we're continuously doing both, and they're continuously feedbacking each other as to, you know, to levels of magnitude less expensive, figure out through prototypes and experiments in the discovery dimension
what it is that the customers are actually going to want, what's actually going to benefit the customers and like make their lives better, far cheaper, right, and far faster than actually building it to find out. And that's, and that in my mind is the big difference, especially coming from the agile side.
If you look, well, I have to take a step back and ask, because you mentioned that, you know, a lot of these ideas have, you know, been around for a long time, but it's been, you know, nicely put together and conceptualized, you know, by him in this model. Do you see a parallel with, you know, the Lean Startup? And, you know, because when that book came out and everyone was talking about the Lean Startup, it was very much a way to look at, like, you know, how does successful startups operate, and then bigger companies wanted to work more in that way. They basically wanted to operate more like a startup. Is there a bit of a parallel between these two?
Yeah, I'd say absolutely that any large organization has now become in some way, shape, or form a technology company, and to a certain extent, probably a product company too. When I was working for the real estate holding company as an agile coach, that was their whole mission, right? It was to figure out how can we become not only more agile, but become more product focused in our offerings, and moving away from more of just a pure service organization mindset. And it's a very challenging thing to do, to kind of reverse engineer that, but that's what these transformations are all about. And that's absolutely what they're trying to do, is they're trying to become as nimble as a startup. And, you know, you hear it in the news where, you know, certain companies say we want to be the biggest startup on the planet, right? And to be fair, a lot of these companies that are incredibly successful today, like the Amazon to the world, they evolved essentially as product companies. They evolved with this mindset, right? They were essentially almost born this way. And that's what other larger, more traditional companies want to emulate. And that's where that's why there's so much talk about this.
I really agree. When I when I've been studying, you know, the product operating model, it resonates with a book that I read not too long ago, which was the collective writings of Jeff Bezos. And if you distill some practices from these collective writings of Jeff Bezos in that book, there's a lot of parallels, you know. So I think your analogy here with Amazon is very, very good. And of course, you know, which company doesn't want to be as successful as Amazon? So,
and another key kind of point there too is, if you're used to working on a traditional feature team, it's not just the change for middle management, or whatever. It's also a change for your individual developers, your individual engineers, because you're now held. When you move to this product model, when you move to even a more agile, self-empowered team, self-managed team, as it was intended, I've rarely seen it. You're also now accountable. You're not just accountable for creating that feature. You're also accountable because you're on this empowered product team to come up with the right solution. You can't just say, well, I delivered the feature and the customer doesn't like it. That's not my problem. That's somebody else's job. That is now your job too. That's another huge difference. And not everybody's going to like that, but some people are going to thrive in that environment.
So if we look at, these three dimensions then. So, you know, first we have, you know, which problem to solve, you know, the product strategy. And then we have, how we're going to solve these problems, you know, being the product discovery. And then finally, in this model, you know, we have to
how you build, test, and deploy this this solution, which is the product delivery. You already touched upon that. The third dimension here, the product delivery. This is where good agile practices comes in, but now we're also having a more holistic approach where we also have the discovery and strategy. Shall we look at this in a very as happening on the basically the same level in the organization, or is there a bit of a hierarchy here because if I think about this from a startup point of view, when you start a company, there is this problem you really want to solve, so that fits very well with product strategy there. And then you have an idea about how to solve that. You need to, of course, you need to make it happen and create your, first, lovable, product. So in many ways, it's very easy to look at this model from a startup point of view. It's like, this is kind of like the origin story of, how you build a startup and scale a startup. But is it fair to look at it in that kind of, let's say, a little bit hierarchical view, or would you see it more flat?
No, I mean, I think you nailed it when you talked about it from a startup perspective, and it's usually the founder or one of the co-founders who's that chief product officer. It's the person who's coming up with that customer-driven product vision. It's a very distinct vision as to what is it that we're going to do to make the world better, right? Like Asana's customer-driven product vision is, we want to help humanity thrive by enabling the world's teams to work together effortlessly. It's like in a video game, this X statement. It's like, what is going to make this really resonate with the customer and help the customer's lives be better in some way, shape, or form? And it's typically, as you just said, that's typically going to be one of the founders of a startup who takes on that role and creates that vision, who has that vision and wants to drive it. And even in a larger organization, there's still going to be hierarchy. There's no escaping it. And the difference being is, and I think this is where a lot of the agile principles also come into play, servant leadership. The leaders have to be much more involved. It's not just another good thing that Marty Kagan says, right, for example, is all companies want to use, everybody wants to use OKRs. Most companies fail with OKRs, and they fail with OKRs because it's this throw it over the fence hierarchical way of looking at things, where we set the objectives, or set the objectives with the team, and then we kind of tune out and we let the teams do what they need to do, and we come back and check and see if they hit the objectives at the end of the quarter. The leaders, and this is so true, right? And your analogy with the startups is dead on, because the founders who are the product leaders of a startup, they're involved all the time. They don't just kind of throw it over the fence and say, let's see how this works out at the end of the quarter. And you have, in all levels here, despite how deep the hierarchy is, have to be involved in achieving this customer-driven product vision. And it's not just on a quarterly basis. It's not just on a monthly basis. It's on a daily basis.
So, this brings us a bit to the territory which is extra close to heart for me as founder and CEO of Favro. And you dropped Asana before, and Asana together with Jira and Monday are probably the most common tools that people have used before moving to Favro. And I think a connection between this stuff and Favro is that the first thing is that you need not only ways of working, but that also in whatever tool you're using, that basically enables empowerment on each level. So if the ones working with the delivery needs to really be empowered, both in their responsibility, their ownership, and their tooling to do that, but then also the ones responsible working with discovery and strategy, And I think the thing which is very often going wrong is that it's the collaboration between them, because it's not, these are not isolated, you know, islands or isolated, you know, levels of the hierarchy. You know, the more collaborative it will be between them, it's going to be more of a, you know, the wheels are going to spin faster, and you're also going to be operating with, you're going to be operating faster, and you're also going to be operating with, well, basically better, with lack of a better word. You know, there's always, you know, when you get to the details of these things, you know, you get into problems like, you know, expectations being wrong. You know, on one level, they think we're almost done, you know, with the solution, and on the solution level, you kind of just discover that no, we're actually quite far from done. We need to you know, reiterate this, because we're not there yet, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so the more, you know, collaborative it is, you know, between teams, not only teams side by side, if you're doing something big, but also, you know, vertically in your organization, I think the faster the wheels can turn. And it's my impression is that, you know, this model actually puts quite a lot of emphasis on that.
Absolutely. And it's that again, not just side by side with the delivery teams, but vertically also with just these three dimensions. It's delivery, discovery, strategy, constantly working and collaborating together, as opposed to passing it down the chain and more of a waterfall way. And that's a big difference. And Favreau, I have to say that Favreau is so good at this, because one of the key principles of the product operating model, for example, is transparency, especially on the strategy level or the strategy dimension. And Favreau is excellent at that, right? Because just in the very simple way that what's called a collection in Favreau, which is a single screen, can consist of multiple boards, multiple backlogs, a cohesive dashboard that kind of ties it all together. Where in other tools, you have these tool silos, because you can have maybe just a single board per screen, and it's relevant just to that particular dimension or just to that particular team. And it becomes very difficult to see the big picture. And Favreau takes care of that, not only by having, you know, being able to have multiple boards in a single screen, those boards can be shared across single screens or collections. And you also have the feature of relations, where cards can exist on multiple boards and multiple screens and multiple collections simultaneously. So you're always able to see very clearly what other teams are working on, as well as what other dimensions of, say, a product operating model are working on. It doesn't create those tool silos that you find so often in other tools.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I shall plug here, so, you know, you don't have to do it, that, you know, you are also offering a solution for this model, so you can basically just click in Favreau or click on the Favreau website and get started with this model. And since Favreau is so flexible, you get the model set up and you get a starting point, but you can instantly start modifying it to exactly, you know, your needs. So I'll plug it, so you don't have to, but I want to ask you something else. So where is this going? I mean, obviously, this is very, very hyped right now. As I said, you know, Marty Kagan, you know, he's founder and partner at Silicon Valley Product Group, and so this is something very much coming out of Silicon Valley, and obviously Silicon Valley is very, very good at you know, has always been very good at product management. A lot of the most successful product companies in the world, you know, come from there. And as with most trends coming out of Silicon Valley, it kind of starts there, it gets traction there, and then spreads to the rest of the world. What is your read on, you know, how far it come? You know, sometimes when people like you and I are observing that a trend is having very, very strong momentum, it's still actually just very early stage, you know. It might be that a lot of people talk about it in Silicon Valley, but if you take your let's say big enterprise in Germany or Sweden, they might still not actually be familiar with it. I mean, what's your read on how far it's come in its penetration of the global market?
I think it's massive. I think any startup, tech startup worth its salt is going to read these books, right? Any tech startup worth their salt is going to really strive to adhere to this conceptual model in some way, shape, or form. And to your point about the solution in Favreau, Marty Kagan writes very specifically that he doesn't advocate for any specific tool. He actually advocates against any specific tool, process, or framework, right? And that's not what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is give you essentially a solution, a template, a starting point to make this a reality. And in my mind, that's what tools do. Tools help teams, they help entire organizations turn any conceptual model into a reality, into a pragmatic, we can make this work reality. And I think Favreau is excellent at that because it has that flexibility and has that transparency. As far as, how far has this come? How far is it going to go? I think this is huge. I think this is the best packaging, so to say. It's the best. It's the best thing I've seen in my entire career to solve the problem of the hierarchy of the us versus them, of the business side versus the tech versus the development side, right? It solves that problem because startup technologies companies don't have that problem because they're born technology first, right? They don't have this. It has to, either work for the business or it works for the customer, right? It needs to work for both. And that's what this product model is really bringing to the table. Solutions to problems that work for both the business and the customer ultimately. And everybody is involved in coming up with those solutions. Everybody in the organization in a very, not flat, but a relatively flat, more empowered team type of way. And that's what I've always liked most about Agile. That's what drew me to Agile is the whole concept in the empowered, self-managed, self-organized team. Again, I've rarely seen it. I think this is the best chance we have at really achieving those empowered teams, those empowered, self-managed, self-organized teams. And it's also, I'll go so far as to say is it's the best chance we have of saving Agile. Because it plays such an important role specifically in the delivery dimension.
That is truly exciting, and I agree with you that in times when there's been a lot of negativity around a lot of things, this is a very positive trend that I think will make a lot of organizations simply better and also more rewarding to work in.
Yeah, I agree. This is the type of organization I want to work in, would want to work in as an organization that has adopted these principles and works in this way. And I think a lot of people would feel the same. Does it come with more accountability? Does it come with more responsibility? Yes. But as you and I working together so long, right? The people who have thrived at Favreau have been essentially the ones who have had that mindset, who have had that, I'm not just told what to do and how to do it. I'm empowered to really come up with solutions, really come up with, take those initiatives, right? Be empowered to make those decisions. And not everybody's comfortable with that, but the people who are, that's the type of organization they want to work with.
I hope you liked that interview. If you did, you know what to do. Share it on your favorite social media so others can learn from the Favreau community.